demanded. What punishment will he receive for his blatant disregard of the law? Dan smiled his brightest. Why, he'll have to work for me. That ought to be punishment enough. Dan and his lawyer rode alone in his private trolley back to Astro's main base of the great ringed plain of Alphonsus, where Yamagata Industries had set up its first and still largest lunar center. One of the privileges of great wealth was privacy. Another was convenience. Dan was one of only two men who had a private trolley vehicle on the moon. The other was Saito Yamagata, once Dan's boss, for many years now his friend and sometime partner. Like cable cars that climb mountains or cross chasms on Earth, the lunar trolleys were suspended from cables made of lunar aluminum and titanium. Cryogenically cooled, the cables carried electricity at low resistance that powered the trolleys swiftly and smoothly 10 meters above the battered lunar terrain.
You almost blew it, boss, said his lawyer.
She was sitting in a softly yielding padded chair, swirling a drink she had fixed for herself at the minibar. Dan looked up from the display screen built into his desktop. Close doesn't count, except in horseshoes, Scarlet.
My name is Catherine, she said with a slight frown. My friends call me Kate.
And what should I call you? The frown turned into a grin. They had played this little game 1,000 times in the years that she had worked for Dan Randolph.
Ms. Williams will do.
Scarlet, he said. With that brick top of yours, your name has to be Scarlet. She went back to frowning. That is your natural hair color, isn't it? Before she could answer, Dan added, Doesn't matter. It's gorgeous. Never change it. She cocked an eyebrow as if she were going to retort, but thought better of it and sipped at her drink. Dan went back to scrolling through the messages that had accumulated during the morning. One of them was from Zachary Freiberg, his chief scientist. Dan routed all the other messages to the people he hired to get things done. Zach Freiberg, he called himself. The scientist's message was marked urgent and asked Dan to call immediately, regardless of time zones on Earth. Dan called out Freiberg's name to the computer, and within seconds his face appeared on the screen. What's wrong, Zach? Freiberg was obviously in his office in California. Tawny brown hills showed through the window behind him, with palm trees and cypresses framing the view. From the angle of the sun, Dan guessed it was mid-morning in Pasadena. He registered all this during the couple of seconds it took for his words to reach Earth and Freiberg's reply to return the 250,000 miles to the moon. Zachary Freiberg had one of those faces that would look boyish to the day he died. Round apple cheeks, round chin, soft features, and soft blue eyes. His wiry strawberry blonde hair no longer flopped over his broad forehead, though. In the 10 years that Dan had known Zach, the slow recession of his hairline had been the one sign of aging he could see. Zach looked troubled.
Can we go to security mode?
I'm on the trolley, moving too fast for a laser link. Freiberg bit his lower lip. We can scramble, Dan suggested. Or wait till I'm back in the office and we can use the laser.
Scramble then, said Freiberg 2.5 seconds later.
Wondering what could be making him so upset, Dan typed in his private security code. The screen flickered briefly, then steadied once again. What is it? He asked. Unconsciously, Freiberg hunched closer to his screen, like a man about to whisper a secret in a neighborhood bar.
I've been looking at the long-term climate trends, he said.
You remember you wanted to get a better fix on the greenhouse effect? Dan nodded, glancing at Kate Williams. She was staring through the window by her seat, watching the pockmarked Mare Cognitum whiz by. How big are her ears? Dan wondered. I remember asking you about the long-term effects of the greenhouse warming, yeah, he replied to Freiberg. If the sea level keeps rising, we'll have to build a dike around the launching center at La Guayra.
Right.
Freiberg's round face took on an even more anguished look.
Dan, if what I've come up with is right, and I think it is, we're in for big problems. I mean, major catastrophe.
Will we have to abandon the launch center?
It's worse than that, Dan. A whole lot worse. It's not just Astro. It's the whole fucking world.
Dan had never heard Freiberg use that expletive before. The guy's scared. Without waiting for Dan to ask, Freiberg went on.
It's a cliff, Dan. The climate doesn't change gradually. It all of a sudden shifts and bang, you've got the glaciers melting down. Greenland and Antarctica melting down. The sea levels going up 30 meters. Rainfall patterns radically shifting. All the coastlines on Earth inundated. It's a mess. A goddamn catastrophe like out of the Bible. Dan sank back in his chair. Kate Williams saw the expression on his face and stared at him. Nobody's considered the gas hydrates in the deep-sea sediments, Freiberg was almost babbling. And under the tundra, all across the Arctic. They release methane when they're disturbed, and the pressure conditions... When? Dan asked. How soon?
Soon. A few decades. Maybe as soon as 10 years from now.
He ran a hand across his forehead.
I think maybe it's already started.
You're sure? Certain? Freiberg nodded unhappily.
I've had a half dozen people check it out. It's real. Floods, killer storms, crop lands turn to deserts, the whole thing. All that stuff the environmentalists have been spouting for the past 50 years, it's all going to happen, Dan. And it'll happen so fast there's practically nothing we can do about it.
We've got 10 years?
Maybe more. Maybe less.
Dan sucked in a deep breath. He knew he should feel alarmed, frightened. But he did not. He was more annoyed than anything else. His mind accepted what Freiberg was saying. He knew intellectually that this was a real emergency looming, a disaster of incalculable proportions. But deep in his innermost animal being, he felt no terror, no panic. The reality of this threat was too remote, too academic to spark his emotions. And that's the real danger of it, he told himself. It's too far in the future to stir the guts, even though it's close enough to kill us all. To Freiberg, he said, "Haul your ass up here, Zach. I want to go through this with you inch by inch." Freiberg nodded glumly.
"The numbers aren't going to change, boss."
"Yeah, I know. But there must be something we can do about it."
"Learn to swim," said Freiberg.
4. The Global Economic Council was headquartered in Paris, a city just beginning to brighten once again after the turmoil of the past few decades. Western Europe had found it much more difficult to digest Eastern Europe than even the most pessimistic economic forecaster had predicted. After more than 4 decades of stagnation and repression, the peoples of Eastern Europe shouted for democracy and freedom. What they really wanted was the economic well-being of their Western neighbors, the higher standard of living that they saw in the capitalist nations. But the capitalist idea of working hard was foreign to them. At first, they demanded bread and meat and milk for their children. And they got it, for it was impossible for the West to deny humanitarian aid to their impoverished brethren. But quickly they began to demand the toys and trinkets of capitalist societies, without working to produce the wealth that could pay for them. A whole generation simmered in distrust and bitter animosities, as slowly, painfully, the peoples of the formerly socialist world learned that it was the capitalists who truly followed Marx's original dictum, from each according to his ability, to each according to his work. At last, the Poles and Czechs and Romanians, and even the Russians, learned to work once again, learned to produce the goods and services that paid for their happiness. The Hungarians reasserted their marketing craft. The centuries-old hatreds between ethnic groups were subdued, but not entirely forgotten, in the new rush to obtain expensive gadgets and personal wealth. Now Paris was a happy city once more. The economic boom was partially fueled from space. Much of the wealth that allowed Europe and the rest of the world to prosper came from the energy, the raw materials, the manufactured products produced in space. From the moon came raw materials for space construction and isotopic fuel for Earth's fusion power generators. From factories in space came new alloys and electronics crystals, medicines and vaccines of incredible purity, solar voltaic cells cheap and efficient enough to turn a family's home rooftop into a self-sufficient solar energy generator. And, hovering in orbit around the Earth, giant solar power satellites converted unfiltered sunlight into electricity and beamed it to energy-hungry cities and factories cleanly without polluting the atmosphere. The economic boom that was just getting started
was heavily dependent on this new wealth streaming